welcome to the Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles. When we look at bestseller lists, mysteries, murder, and mayhem are always at the top of the charts. We love our amateur sleuths, our investigators, our PIs. Today, let's return to the scene of the crime and hunt down new mystery titles worthy of your time. And we'll speak with two authors at the top of their genre. Let's get this investigation started as we turn to page one of the book report. Been dreaming of a new kitchen? One right for the way you cook, for optimizing your space and your unique style? Lifestyles Kitchens has a menu of options that work within your budget. Lifestyles Kitchens is one of New England's top design studios. Our professional designers come to your home, assess your space, cooking style, and guide you through a wide world of choices. Then we'll design the perfect kitchen or bath with you. Start with cabinets from Woodmode, Brookhaven, Candlelight, DBS, or Neff. Add exquisite counters of granite, engineered stone, and more, and finish with fabulous fixtures. Your dream kitchen doesn't come out of a box or a big box store. And for a truly memorable gift for those special to you, consider Lifestyles Kitchens gift certificates. Contact us today at lifestyleskitchens.com. That's two S's, lifestyleskitchens.com. Robert Crace has written extraordinary novels of crime and suspense for 25 years. Many feel his new work, Suspect, may be his most remarkable novel to date. LAPD cop Scott James is not doing well. Not since a nighttime assault killed his partner, Stephanie, nearly killed him, and left him enraged and ashamed. His new partner, Maggie, is not doing well either. The German Shepherd survived 3 tours in Iraq and Afghanistan, sniffing explosives before she lost her handler to an IED and sniper attack. Man and dog are each other's last chance. He was a young cop on the rise. She was bred to guard and protect. Now they are shunned and shunted to the side. They are suspect. Together, they set out to investigate the one case no one wants them to touch, finding the men who murdered Stephanie. McLeod Andrews narrates.
They were on that particular street at that specific T intersection at that crazy hour because Scott James was hungry. Stephanie shut off their patrol car to please him. They could have been anywhere else, but he led her there that night to that silent intersection. It was so quiet that night they spoke of it. Unnaturally quiet. They stopped 3 blocks from the Harbor Freeway between rows of crappy 4-story buildings everyone said would be torn down to build a new stadium if the Dodgers left Chavez Ravine. The buildings and streets in that part of town were deserted. No homeless people, no traffic, no reason for anyone to be there that night, even an LAPD radio car. Stephanie frowned.
You sure you know where you're going?
I know where I'm going, just hang on. Scott was trying to find an all-night noodle house a Rampart robbery detective had raved about. One of those pop-up places that takes over an empty storefront for a couple of months, hypes itself on Twitter, then disappears. A place the robbery dick claimed had the most amazing ramen in Los Angeles. Latin-Japanese fusion, flavors you couldn't get anywhere else. Cilantro tripe, abalone chili, a jalapeno duck to die for. Scott was trying to figure out how he had screwed up the directions when he suddenly heard it.
Listen.
What?
Shh, listen. Turn off the engine.
You have no idea where this place is, do you?
You have to hear this. Listen.
Uniformed LAPD officer Stephanie Anders, a P3 with 11 years on the job, shifted into park, turned off their Adam car, and stared at him. She had a fine tanned face with lines at the corners of her eyes and short sandy hair. Scott James, a 32-year-old P2 with 7 years on the job, grinned as he touched his ear, telling her to listen. Stephanie seemed lost for a moment, then blossomed with a wide smile.
It's quiet.
Crazy, huh? No radio calls, no chatter. I can't even hear the freeway. It was a beautiful spring night. Temp in the mid-60s, clear. The kind of windows-down, short-sleeve weather Scott enjoyed. Their call log that night showed less than a third their usual number of calls, which made for an easy shift, but left Scott bored. Hence, their search for the unfindable Noodle House, which Scott had begun to believe might not exist. Stephanie reached to start the car, but Scott stopped her. "Let's sit for a minute. How many times you hear silence like this?"
"Never.
This is so cool. It's creeping me out."
"Don't worry, I'll protect you."
Stephanie laughed, and Scott loved how the streetlights gleamed in her eyes. He wanted to touch her hand, but didn't. They'd been partners for 10 months, but now Scott was leaving, and there were things he wanted to say.
"You've been a good partner."
"Are you going to get all gooey on me?"
"Yeah, kinda."
"Okay, well, I'm going to miss you.
I'm going to miss you more."
Their little joke. Everything a competition. Even to who would miss the other the most. Again, he wanted to touch her hand. But then she reached out and took his hand in hers. And gave him a squeeze.
We have just heard Suspect by Robert Kreiss. Powerful players, ruthless politicians, intrigue, and passion. In The Tangled Web, author J.P. Lane takes you on a suspense-packed global trek fraught with paid assassins and deadly plots. Who will be snared in this network of murder and mayhem? Grab The Tangled Web and find out at Kindle stores and iBookstore worldwide. Reviews and more at jp-lane.com. I'm thrilled to welcome Harlan Coben back to the Book Report. Coben has more than 50 million books in print worldwide. In addition to his incredibly popular Myron Bolitar series, including Drop Shot and The Final Detail, he introduced the Mickey Bolitar series for younger readers. Coben is the winner of the Edgar Award, the Seamus, and the Anthony Award, the first author to win all three. His work has been called ingenious by the New York Times and consistently entertaining by the Houston Chronicle. In early works, Coben immersed himself in the exploits of sports agent Myron Bolitar. After 7 books, Coben wanted to try something different. The result was the critically acclaimed New York Times bestseller, Tell No One, which became one of 2001's most decorated thrillers. And it was turned into a blockbuster film in France. Today, we'll speak with Harlan about his newest title, 6 Years. Welcome, Harlan. So glad to have you back with us on the Book Report.
Nice to be here, Elaine. Thanks.
6 Years is a standalone novel with Professor Jake Fisher at its core. Introduce Jake to our listeners.
Well, I'll just read you the first line of the book, and maybe that'll do it. The first line of the book is, "I sat in the back pew and watched the only woman I would ever love marry another man."
You know, I was going to tell you that, in fact, I love that opening line, and I know that you're a writer known for amazing opening lines. How do you keep crafting them?
This one actually came to me very quickly. I mean, I wanted to open the book with this man at the wedding of the woman he loved, heartbroken, devastated, and for her to say to him, you know, "Promise me you'll leave us alone, you respect my opinion, you'll let us live our lives." And the very last line of the prologue is, "I kept that promise for 6 years," title of the book. So I kind of love that kind of opening, very dramatic, heartbreaking scene right away that will come back to haunt us throughout the book.
Yeah, and I know I just heard the news that Hugh Jackman is set to star in the big screen adaptation. Congratulations.
Thanks. It's the first time before the book was even out, Paramount Pictures optioned it for Hugh Jackman, who read an early draft. Hugh read one of the early advanced copies himself, and he's a really enthusiastic, great guy, a wonderful reader, and I'm obviously clearly a talented guy, too. So I'm really looking forward to seeing what he does with the character.
Yeah. Now, Lee Child did a cameo appearance in his movie last year based on his book. Can we expect to see you in 6 years?
Oh, I did a, when we did the French movie of Tell No One, I got a cameo. So I'm hoping, you know, I'm just a little worried if I'm on the set at the same time as Hugh Jackman. People mix us up looks-wise.
But do you sing? Can you do Les Mis?
So I don't know. I'll have to talk to the producers about my role, as it were, in the movie.
All right. So in the book, things really start going sour for Jake once he tries to find his beloved Natalie. Well, you were in the middle of writing it. Did you know exactly where the book was going? There were so many twists and turns.
I did know the ending. I know nothing in between. I compare it to driving from my home state of New Jersey across the country to California. I may go Route 80. I may go via the Suez Canal. But I always end up in California. In this case, you know, the 6 years pass. He sees an obituary for his lover, the woman he loves, husband. So he decides to go to the funeral and just sort of see what's what. And when the wife stands up and turns around, it's not the woman he loved. She's never been married to this guy. No one knows who she is. No one knows where she's been for the 6 years. And even when he goes back to the wedding chapel, no one there remembers this wedding or remembers either Jake or Natalie. So that's how the book opens up, and from there it just races along.
Okay, I have kind of a girl comment to tell you.
Yep.
Jake is a guy that is just so in love with Natalie, and I think it's quite rare to see a mystery thriller character who wears his heart on his sleeve. Have you been hearing lots of comments from your women readers?
Yes. This, you know, Tell No One and now 6 years are the two that I've written that are both really love stories. They are, they're thrillers, and bodies start piling up, and there's a lot of danger, there's some plenty of action pieces, but really this is more a love story than a thriller, and it's all about a man trying to find out what really happened in that chapel, what really happened when he was so sure this woman was the one. What really happened 6 years ago.
Well, you know, I really love Jake, besides the fact that he was incredibly good-looking. I know you wrote him that way. I mean, he's a guy that you can connect with. He's a really good guy.
Well, thanks. I mean, this is one of the few books, 6 years, that I did entirely first person because I wanted you in Jake's head the whole time. I wanted his confusion to be your confusion, his heartache to be your heartache, his paranoia and fear to be yours. And I'm really pleased with the way both men and women relate, but I'm glad you fell in love with them a little bit.
I did.
That's part of the joy of it, isn't it?
Well, you know, I also loved a lot of your supporting characters. I especially loved Benedict Edwards. Tell us more about him.
Well, I'm a big fan of the sidekick. My Myron Bolitar series, he has a sidekick named Wynn. And so Jake's best friend is another professor there who's also a bit of a playa with the ladies. Named Benedict, who I think he's pretty hilarious, and they have a good time with him. And he plays a fairly crucial role as his best friend, trying to help him through this muddle of a mess.
Yeah, I liked Cookie too. She was kind of had a lot of grit, I think.
Well, thanks. You know, I love to write every character, but you know, I work very hard in my own mind. Anyway, they all have a whole life and a whole side story. Every one of them has secrets of their own. Every one of them, I hope, surprises you in some way and feels real. Some add comic possibilities. Mrs. Dinsmore, who works at his office with him, even in the heat of the worst battle, even in his most depressed, she still, you know, he still will crack jokes with her. I think that gives the books, number one, a feeling of realism, and number two, maybe part of the reason that you fall in love with Jake is he has a sense of humor. I keep hearing from the ladies that sense of humor is the number one thing. So maybe that those kind of characters help me prove that.
Yeah. Well, I know that you've been writing a young adult series, Mickey Bolitar. So are you writing several novels at once? Do you do like a YA and an adult one at the same time?
I can never do two at the same time. I do one, then the next.
Mm-hmm.
I had two of the young adults out, Shelter and Seconds Away, which I'm loving the parents are reading with the teens. It's really been a great deal of fun. I do hope to write the third. I'm not exactly sure when I'll get to it, but there will be a third in the Mickey Bolitar series, too.
Mm, might we see Jake again in one of your books?
You know, he might. Normally when I write a character in a standalone, so far they've never come back for a second book, but Jake is calling to me, so it may happen.
Well, the ladies kind of love him, so he gets my vote. Anyway, what next project are you working on for adults?
I'm just starting the next book soon. I think it'll be another standalone, similar, in other words, like 6 years rather than the Myron series. I'm also working on a Myron Bolitar TV series with Carol Mendelson, who created the CSI franchise. So, you know, a bunch of different things going on. I may help work on the movie 6 years as well. We'll see.
Oh, that's great. Well, thanks very much for joining us today, Harlan. I loved this book. I have to tell you that I kind of sat down on my couch and read the whole thing at once. It was that good.
Isn't that a fun feeling, though? I love that feeling. And the fact that you're kind enough to tell me that I helped you experience it means a great deal to me. It really does. Thank you.
All right. Well, thanks so much.
Bye.
And now let's hear a sampling of 6 years, performed by Scott Brick.
But I could see something tighten around her mouth. She knew that I was in the room. She kept her eyes on her husband-to-be. His name, I had recently found out, was Todd. I hate the name Todd. Todd. They probably called him Toddy, or the Todd Man, or the Toddster. Todd's hair was too long, and he sported that 4-day stubble beard some people found hip, and others, like me, found punchworthy. His eyes smoothly and smugly skimmed the guests before getting snagged on, well, me. They stayed there a second, sizing me up before deciding that I wasn't worth the time. Why had Natalie gone back to him? The maid of honor was Natalie's sister Julie. She stood on the dais with a bouquet in both hands and a lifeless, robotic smile on her lips. We'd never met, but I'd seen pictures and heard them talk on the phone. Julie, too, looked stunned by this development. I tried to meet her eye, but she was working that 1,000-yard stare. I looked back at Natalie's face, and it was as if small explosives detonated in my chest. Just boom, boom, boom. Man, this had been a bad idea. When the best man brought out the rings, my lungs started shutting down. It was hard to breathe. Enough. I had come here to see it for myself, I guess. I had learned the hard way that I needed that. My father died of a massive coronary 5 months ago. He had never had a heart problem before, and was, by all accounts, in good shape. I remembered sitting in that waiting room, being called into the doctor's office, being told the devastating news, and then being asked, both there and at the funeral home, if I wanted to see his body. I passed. I figured that I didn't want to remember him lying on a gurney or in a casket. I would remember him as he was. But as time went on, I started having trouble accepting his death. He had been so vibrant, so alive. 2 days before his death, we had gone to a New York Rangers hockey game. Dad had season tickets, and the game had gone into overtime, and we screamed and cheered and, well, how could he be dead? Part of me started wondering if somehow there had been a mistake made, or if it was all a great big con and that my dad was maybe somehow still alive. I know that makes no sense, but desperation can toy with you, and if you give desperation any wiggle room, it will find alternative answers. Part of me was haunted by the fact that I never saw my father's body. I didn't want to make the same mistake here. But to keep within this lame metaphor, I had now seen the dead body. There was no reason to check the pulse or poke at it or hang around it longer than necessary. I tried to make my departure as inconspicuous as I could. This is no easy feat when you're 6'5 and are built, to use Natalie's phrase, like a lumberjack. I have big hands. Natalie had loved them. She would hold them in her own and trace the lines on my palm. She said they were real hands, man's hands. She had drawn them, too, because, she said, they told my story. My blue-collar upbringing, my working my way through Lanford College as a bouncer at a local nightclub, and also, somehow, the fact that I was now the youngest professor in their political science department. I stumbled out of the small white chapel and into the warm summer air.
We've just heard 6 Years by Harlan Coben. This year, small is the next big thing. That's why the Itsy Bitsy Ritzy Shop is building elegant, affordable small space furniture for your little place. Itsy Bitsy Ritzy Shop furniture is handcrafted in America with a more petite footprint to make any room look larger. It's furniture that multitasks like you do, and most of it has storage built in. To see a little more, visit ibrshop.com. That's ibrshop.com, where small is beautiful. Justin and Libby Denby have the kind of life found in the pages of a glossy magazine. A beautiful 14-year-old daughter, a brownstone in Boston's Back Bay, a great marriage admired by all. But in Lisa Gardner's Touch and Go, all is not what it seems. When investigator Tessa Leone arrives at the crime scene in the Denby's home, she finds scuff marks on the floor and a million tiny pieces of bright green taser confetti. The family appears to have been abducted, with only a pile of their cell phones and electronic devices remaining. No witnesses, no ransom demands, no motive. Tessa knows that flawless fronts can hide dark secrets. Now she must race against the clock to uncover the Denbys' innermost dealings, a complex tangle of friendships and betrayal, big business and small sacrifices. Who would want to kidnap such a perfect family? And how far would such a person be willing to go? Elizabeth Rogers narrates.
In the beginning, that's one of the things I'd loved most about him. A man's man. Comfortable in a wood-paneled boardroom, but also played a mean game of pickup hoops and thought nothing of taking his favorite .357 to light up the firing range. When we were first dating, he'd take me with him to his gun club. I'd stand, tucked into the solid embrace of his larger, stronger body, while he showed me how to position my hands on the grip of a relatively petite .22, how to sight down the barrel, home in on the bullseye. The first few times, I missed the target completely, the sound of the gunshot startling me, causing me to flinch even with ear protection. I'd fire into the ground, or, if I was very lucky, hit the lowest edge of the paper target. Time and time again, Justin would patiently correct me, his voice a low rumble against the back of my neck as he leaned over and helped me level out my aim. Sometimes we never made it home. We'd end up naked in the closet of the rifle range, or in the back seat of his SUV, still in the parking lot. Salt. Gunpowder. Oranges. Justin excused himself to use the bathroom. When he left, I rearranged the pasta on my plate so it would appear as if I'd eaten. Then, I opened my purse, and, under the cover of the table, doled out 4 white pills. I popped them as a single handful, chased down with half a glass of water. Then I picked up my glass of champagne and steeled myself for the evening's main event. Justin drove us the 5 minutes home. He'd purchased the Boston townhouse pretty much the same day we'd confirmed that I was pregnant. From doctor's office to real estate office, he brought me to see it after reaching a verbal agreement, the big game hunter showing off his trophy. I probably should have been offended by his high-handedness. Instead, I'd walked through 4.5 stories of gorgeous hardwood floors, soaring 9-foot ceilings and intricate hand-carved moldings, and felt my jaw drop. So this is what $5 million bought you. Bright, sunlit rooms, a charming rooftop patio, not to mention an entire neighborhood of beautifully restored red brick buildings, nestled shoulder to shoulder like long-lost friends. The townhome was on tree-lined Marlborough Street, just blocks away from Tony Newberry Street, not to mention walking distance to the public gardens. The kind of neighborhood where the poor people drove Saabs, The nannies spoke with French accents, and the private school had an application process that started the baby's first week of conception. Justin gave me carte blanche. Furniture, art, draperies, carpets. Antiques, no antiques, interior decorator, no interior decorator. He didn't care. Do whatever I had to do, spend whatever I had to spend. Just make this our home. So I did. Like that scene out of Pretty Woman, except it involved slathering painters and decorators and antique dealers, all plying their wares while I sat my pregnant bulk on various divans and with an elegant wave of my hand ordered a bit of this, a dash of that. Frankly, I had fun with it. Finally, a real-world application for my fine art skills. I could not only fashion jewelry out of silver-infused clay, I could renovate a Boston brownstone. We were giddy those days. Justin was working a major hydroelectric project. He'd helicopter in and out, literally, and I'd show off the latest progress on our home, while he rubbed my lower back and brushed back my hair to nuzzle the side of my neck. Then, Ashlyn. And joy, 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 happy, happy, happy. Justin beamed, snapped photos, showed off his precious baby girl to anyone who made eye contact. His crew filed into our Boston townhouse, muddy boots left in the gleaming foyer so a bunch of former Navy SEALs and ex-Marines could make googly eyes at our sleeping daughter in her pink-coated nursery.
That was Touch and Go by Lisa Gardner. The Sound of Broken Glass is book 15 in the James and Kincaid series. It begins on a cold January morning in London. Detective Inspector Gemma James is back on the job now that her husband, Detective Superintendent Duncan Kincaid, is at home to care for their 3-year-old foster daughter. Assigned to lead a murder investigation in South London, she is assisted by her colleague, Detective Sergeant Melody Talbot. Their case? A crime scene at a seedy hotel in Crystal Palace. The victim, a well-respected banister, found naked, trussed, and apparently strangled. Is it an unsavory accident or murder? Gemma's team embarks on a search that takes them into unexpected corners and forces them to contemplate unsettling truths about the weaknesses and passions that lead to murder. Gerard Doyle narrates.
Crystal Palace is an area of South London between Dulwich, Croydon and Brixton. Its name has been associated with many different things. Crystal Palace was originally coined by Punch magazine to describe the Great Exhibition, an iron and glass building designed by Joseph Paxton, moved to Crystal Palace Park in 1854 and destroyed by fire on the 30th of November 1936. Crystal Palace, August, 15 years earlier. He sat on the front steps of the house in Woodland Road, counting the banknotes he'd stored in the biscuit tin, all that was left of his mum's wages. Frowning, he counted again. £10 short. Oh, bloody hell! She'd found the new stash and pilfered it again. Blinking back sudden tears, he scrubbed the back of his hand against his nose, trying to quell the panic rising in his stomach. Panic and hunger. It was only Wednesday, and she didn't get paid again until Saturday. How was he going to feed the two of them on the little bit of money that was left? Not that his mum did much but pick at the eggs and toast he made her when she got up in the mornings. And once she went on at the pub, she seemed to survive on cigarettes and the occasional basket of chips. Chips? His stomach growled. Shut it, he said aloud. He could make toast and Marmite for his supper, and next week he'd do a better job of hiding the money. The last few months he'd taken to waiting for her outside the pub on Saturday nights when she got her pay packet, even though she scolded him for being out alone in the centre of town that late. The publican, Mr. Jenkins, handed him the money directly, accompanied by a wink and a hearty thump on the back. Mr. Jenkins wasn't too bad a bloke, although Andy was sure he kept a bit back for his mum to spend on drink. On the night she came home staggering, he didn't like to think where she'd got the extra cash, nor did he like to think about what would happen when he went back to school after the summer holes. He wouldn't be home when she woke, wouldn't be able to see that she ate, wouldn't be able to make sure she stayed sober, at least until she got to work. She seemed so much worse lately, and if she lost her job... He shook his head, refusing to go down that path. He'd figure out something. He always had. Maybe he could get some kind of a job, now that he was 13. He blinked again, this time because sweat had started to trickle into his eyes. The sun hadn't yet dropped below the houses on the west side of Woodland Road, and hot as it was on the front steps, it was hotter still inside their ground floor flat. Besides, he liked watching the afternoon comings and goings in the road, and the view. Their steep street was tatty, most of the houses in disrepair, some derelict. But if he looked north, down the hill, he could see the green swath of London in the haze, and know that just below his line of vision lay the curve of the Thames. If he walked up to the top of the hill, he could see the heart of the city glimmering like a mirage. Some day he was going to live there, in a place where things happened. He was going to get out of bloody Crystal Palace and take his mum with him. If they lived somewhere else, maybe she would improve. Cheered, he reconsidered the prospect of toast and Marmite. There was a tin of baked beans left in the cupboard. Maybe he'd have that instead, and then the chocolate bar he'd squirreled away. The afternoon dozed on, quiet as the grave, except for the rumble of his stomach. He decided he couldn't put off his tea any longer when he heard the grind of a car's gearbox from the bottom of the hill. A little car was trundling up. He recognised it, a Volkswagen that had seen better days. He recognised the driver too, as the car pulled into the curb in front of the house next door. It was their new next-door neighbour, a widow, his mum said, although he didn't think the woman who climbed out of the car looked old enough to be a widow. More like someone's big sister, with her flowered summer dress and softly waving brown hair.
We've just heard The Sound of Broken Glass by Deborah Crombie. Been dreaming of a new kitchen? One right for the way you cook, for optimizing your space and your unique style? Lifestyles Kitchens has a menu of options that work within your budget. Lifestyles Kitchens is one of New England's top design studios. Our professional designers come to your home, assess your space, cooking style, and guide you through a wide world of choices. Then we'll design the perfect kitchen or bath with you. Start with cabinets from Woodmode, Brookhaven, Candlelight, DBS, or Neff. Add exquisite counters of granite, engineered stone, and more, and finish with fabulous fixtures. Your dream kitchen doesn't come out of a box or a big box store. And for a truly memorable gift for those special to you, consider Lifestyles Kitchens gift certificates. Contact us today at lifestyleskitchens.com. That's two S's, lifestyleskitchens.com. Michael Connelly decided to become a writer after discovering the books of Raymond Chandler while attending the University of Florida. After graduating in 1980, Connelly worked at several Florida newspapers, specializing in the crime beat. In 1986, he and two other reporters spent several months interviewing survivors of a major airline crash. They wrote a magazine story about the crash, which was later shortlisted for the Pulitzer Prize for feature writing. Connelly's reporting on the story brought his work to the attention of the Los Angeles Times and landed him a job there as a crime reporter. After 3 years on the crime beat in L.A., Connelly began writing his first novel. It featured LAPD detective Hermione Bosch. Since then, Connelly has written 25 books in 20 years, 18 of them with Bosch, and he's sold 45 million books worldwide. In 2005, Connelly wrote The Lincoln Lawyer, his first ever legal thriller, and the literary world's introduction to Mickey Haller, the quirky L.A. defense attorney who works out of the backseat of his Lincoln Town Car. The 2011 movie, as we all remember, starred Matthew McConaughey as a very convincing Haller. Connolly's most recent book, The Black Box, debuted this past November on the 20th anniversary of the debut of his first novel, Black Echo. We'll speak with him about it now. Welcome, Michael. It's a thrill to have you on the Book Report.
Thanks for having me on.
The Black Box is your 18th Bosch novel. Why this title for this book?
Well, I like titles that mean different things at different times in the books, and that is the case here. But I guess the overarching title meaning is kind of a metaphor. I think we're all familiar with the black box on airplanes, that if there's an air crash, the investigators look for the black box that contains all the data of what was going on with the plane when it crashed, and from that they can learn what happened. So Harry Bosch, the detective, kind of feels that in every crime scene, every murder scene, there's something there, a black box that contains the answers as to what happened here.
Okay. And what is it about this case, the murder of a Dutch photojournalist, that brings Harry back 20 years later?
I was kind of celebrating my 20 years of being published when I was writing this book, so I wanted the story to last 20 years. So I looked back in 1992, Los Angeles, and quickly came upon the riots that occurred at the end of April. And, you know, I thought that's where I should set this thing. And, you know, so I, you know, created a mystery involving a journalist who was covering the riots who got killed, and it had never been solved. Harry Bosch worked the riots 20 years ago and was at this crime scene for just a very few minutes because of the situation and how dangerous it was, and how people like him, homicide investigators, would move quickly from scene to scene. So he could never do it right back in 1992. He could not give this person a shot at justice, this victim. And so he comes back to it 20 years later.
The black box is dedicated to some strangers who kept you safe while you were covering the aftermath of the Rodney King verdict. Tell us a little about that.
Well, I mean, it's a very weird, surreal, I don't know, every description you can think of, to be in a city that you're very familiar with, and yet it had come apart at the scenes, and there's fires in a lot of areas, there's rioting people, there's protesting people, there are looters. It was a crazy 2 or 3 days. And in one of the situations I was in, I was at actually the place where Rodney King, the person who had been beaten by the police, who set this whole thing off with the trial. I was assigned as a journalist to be at the spot where that incident occurred, the police beating. And there's a lot of people there that grew upset when the verdicts against the police officers for brutality and so forth came back not guilty. And at one point I was surrounded by a lot of angry people, and I didn't know for sure I was going to get out of there in one piece. But suddenly one person in particular, but others, pushed through the crowd, got to me, and escorted me safely to my car so I could get out of there. And, you know, it all happened so quick, I wasn't even able to say thank you, let alone who are you people and what are your names. So it's kind of an anonymous thank you many years later.
Hmm. Can you share the story from The Last Coyote on how Harry got his name?
Well, Harry's mother was a big fan of the painter Hieronymus Bosch. She was a fan of several different areas of art, jazz music in particular, which she'd also passed on to Harry. And she was trying to disguise who his father was, because his father was someone of well-known import in the town of Los Angeles. So she was disguising, you know, who his father was, and put down on his birth certificate for Hieronymus Bosch. In a way, she was kind of saying there's a connection between Bosch's paintings and contemporary Los Angeles, or 1950 Los Angeles when he was born. And she was making that connection, that it was a kind of a garden of earthly delights, but there were consequences for that kind of life.
What I love is that Harry is 60 and he's aging in real time. That's kind of a brave decision on your part. Talk about that.
Well, it only looks great now because I never thought it would last this long. But, you know, in 1992, when the first book came out, I was a working journalist, and I, and my publisher asked for another Harry Bosch novel. Well, I saw this opportunity that if I could keep this going for a few years, I could age him in real time against the evolution of the city and, you know, hopefully raise the thing to a little bit higher level than a puzzle or a whodunit. And so I made that decision to age him in real time. And, you know, that was in 1992, never for a moment believing Harry Bosch would still be around in 2013. And, you know, so I'm running out of time with him because it's not realistic that he'd be running around with a badge and a gun too many years longer. But that's okay. I don't regret the decision. I'm still kind of flabbergasted that here I am all these years later and people still want to read about Harry Bosch.
Yeah. The Brass Verdict, which came out in 2008, introduced Mickey Haller from The Lincoln Lawyer to Bosch. Is there another reunion planned?
It's one of the things I love doing in my books is having characters, intersect with each other. I look at all the books, all 25 of them so far as, you know, one part of one big story or one mosaic. And
can we expect to see Harry on the big screen or TV?
Well, if I'm lucky, it will be the little screen. It will be TV. I'm working on with a company and another writer, a television writer, to put together a project that would bring Harry to television, and if it goes well, I'll know whether that's going to happen or not in the next couple of months.
Mm. And are you already at work on another novel?
Yeah, I'm always on work on a novel. I'm always writing. Right now I'm working on a Lincoln Lawyer novel that will hopefully be out towards the end of this year.
All right. And tell us about Bookish, and what does it bring to your readers? I know it's very new.
Well, I mean, I guess it's so new that we're going to see what it brings to readers, but I think any kind of environment or place where readers can come and learn about good books and pick up recommendations and so forth is a positive thing. So I'm hoping that it will catch on, a lot of people will use it, and, it's a way of spreading the word about reading and literature and particular writers and so forth. So in my mind, it seems to be a win-win situation for everybody.
Well, Michael, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. It's very exciting to speak with someone. I love Harry. I love Mickey. Oh. And I can't wait to read your next one. Thank you. And now let's hear a sampling of The Black Box, book 18 in the Harry Bosch series, narrated by Michael McConaughey.
It was Friday, May 1st. B-Watch was the emergency mobilization designation for Night Watch, a 6 p.m. to 6 a.m. shift. Bosch and Edgar had the back seat, while officers Robledo and Delwyn had the front. Delwyn, in the passenger seat, held his shotgun across his lap and angled up, its muzzle poking through the open window. They were rolling to a dead body found in an alley off Crenshaw Boulevard. The call had been relayed to the Emergency Communication Center by the California National Guard, which had been deployed in the city during the state of emergency. It was only 10:30, and the calls were stacking up. King 16 had already handled a homicide call since coming on shift. A looter shot dead in the doorway of a discount shoe store. The shooter had been the store's owner. That crime scene was contained within the premises of the business, which had allowed Bosch and Edgar to work with relative safety. Robledo and Delwyn posted with shotguns and full riot gear on the sidewalk out front. And that also gave the detectives time to collect evidence, sketch the crime scene, and take their own photos. They recorded the statement of the store owner and watched the videotape from the business's surveillance camera. It showed the looter using an aluminum softball bat to smash through the glass door of the store. The man then ducked in through the jagged opening he had created and was promptly shot twice by the store owner, who was hiding behind the cash counter and waiting. Because the coroner's office was overrun with more death calls than it could handle, the body was removed from the store by paramedics and transported to County USC Medical Center. It would be held there until things calmed down, if they ever did, and the coroner caught up with the work. As far as the shooter went, Bosch and Edgar made no arrest. Whether it was self-defense or murder while lying in wait, the DA's office would make the call later. It was not the right way to proceed, but it would have to do. In the chaos of the moment, the mission was simple. Preserve the evidence, document the scene as well and as fast as possible, and collect the dead. Get in and get out, and do it safely. The real investigation would come later. Maybe. As they drove south on Crenshaw, they passed occasional crowds of people, mostly young men gathered on corners or roving in packs. At Crenshaw and Slauson, a group flying Crips colors jeered as the patrol car moved by at high speed without siren or flashing lights. Bottles and rocks were thrown, but the car moved too fast, and the missiles fell harmlessly behind it.
"We'll be back, don't you worry!"
It was Robledo who had called out, and Bosch had to assume he was speaking metaphorically. The young patrolman's threat was as hollow as the department's response had been once the verdicts were read on live TV Wednesday afternoon. Robledo, behind the wheel, only began to slow as they approached a blockade of National Guard vehicles and soldiers. The strategy drawn up the day before with the arrival of the Guard was to take back control of the major intersections in South LA and then move outward, eventually containing all trouble spots. They were less than a mile from one of those key intersections, Crenshaw and Florence, and the Guard troops and vehicles were already spread up and down Crenshaw for blocks. As he pulled up to the barricade at 62nd Street, Robledo lowered his window. A guardsman with sergeant stripes came to the door and leaned down to look at the car's occupants.
"Sergeant Burstyn, San Luis Obispo. What can I do for you fellows?"
"Homicide," Robledo said. He hooked a thumb toward Bosch and Edgar in the back. Burstyn straightened up and made an arm motion so that a path could be cleared and they could be let through.
"Okay," he said. "She's in the alley on the east side between 66th Place and 67th Street. Go on through and my guys will show you. We'll form a tight perimeter and watch the roof lines. We've had unconfirmed reports of sniper fire in the neighborhood."
We've just heard The Black Box by Michael Connelly. Been dreaming of a new kitchen? One right for the way you cook, for optimizing your space and your unique style? Lifestyles Kitchens has a menu of options that work within your budget. Lifestyles Kitchens is one of New England's top design studios. Our professional designers come to your home, assess your space, cooking style, and guide you through a wide world of choices. Then we'll design the perfect kitchen or bath with you. Start with cabinets from Woodmode, Brookhaven, Candlelight, DBS, or Neff. Add exquisite counters of granite, engineered stone, and more, and finish with fabulous fixtures. Your dream kitchen doesn't come out of a box or a big box store. And for a truly memorable gift for those special to you, consider Lifestyles Kitchens gift certificates. Contact us today at lifestyleskitchens.com. That's two S's, lifestyleskitchens.com. Powerful players, ruthless politicians, intrigue, and passion. In The Tangled Web, author J.P. Lane takes you on a suspense-packed global trek fraught with paid assassins and deadly plots. Who will be snared in this network of murder and mayhem? Grab The Tangled Web and find out at Kindle stores and iBookstore worldwide. Reviews and more at jp-lane.com. R. King enjoys immense popularity for her Mary Russell and Sherlock Holmes mystery series. In Book 10, The God of the Hive, Mary and husband Sherlock Holmes face trouble with Scotland Yard and the deadliest of adversaries. The Washington Post has high praise for this series, affirming that King manages to preserve the integrity of the Holmes character while creating a woman who is astute, edgy, and compelling enough to be Holmes' partner in mind and heart. Jenny Sterlin performs.
Over my pounding heart came a lesser version of the sound. The rush of relief made me stumble forward to drop my armful atop the low stone wall, just visible in the creeping dawn. The cow jerked back, then ambled towards us in curiosity, until the child was patting its sloppy nose. I bent my head over her, letting reaction ebb. Estelle Adler was the lovely, bright, half-Chinese child of my husband's long-lost son, Sherlock Holmes' granddaughter. I had made her acquaintance little more than 2 hours before, and known of her existence for less than 3 weeks. But if the maniac who had tried to sacrifice her father, and who had apparently intended to take the child for his own, had appeared from the night, I would not hesitate to give my life for hers. She had been drugged by said maniac the night before, which no doubt contributed to her drowsiness. But now she studied the cow with an almost academic curiosity, leaning against my arms to examine its white-splashed nose, which meant that the light was growing too strong to linger. I settled the straps of my rucksack, lumpy with her possessions, and reached to collect this precious and troublesome burden. "Are you..." she began in full voice. "Shh!" I interrupted. "We need to whisper, Estelle."
"Are you tired?"
she tried again, in a voice that, although far from a whisper, at least was not as carrying. "My arms are," I breathed in her ear, "but I'm fine." "I could ride piggyback," she said. "Are you sure?" "I do with Papa." Well, if she could cling to the back of that tall young man, she could probably hang on to me. I shifted the rucksack around and let her climb onto my back, her little hands gripping my collar. I bent, tucking my arms under her legs, and set off again. Much better. It was a good thing Estelle knew what to do, because I was probably the most incompetent nursemaid ever to be put in charge of a child. I knew precisely nothing about children. The only one I had been around for any length of time was an Indian street urchin 3 times this one's age, and with more maturity than many English adults. I had much to learn about small children, such as the ability to ride pickaback, and the inability to whisper. The child's suggestion allowed me to move faster down the rutted track. We were in the Orkneys, a scatter of islands past the north of Scotland, coming down from the hill that divided the main island's 2 parts. Every step took us farther away from my husband, from Estelle's father, Damien, and from the bloody, fire-stained, prehistoric altar stone where Thomas Brothers had nearly killed both of them. "Why not bring in the police?" one might ask. They can be useful, and after all, Brothers had killed at least 3 others. However, things were complicated. Not that complicated wasn't a frequent state of affairs in the vicinity of Sherlock Holmes, but in this case, the complication took the form of warrants posted for my husband, his son, and me. Estelle was the only family member not being actively hunted by Scotland Yard, including, apparently and incredibly, Holmes' brother. For 40-odd years, Mycroft Holmes had strolled each morning to a grey office in Whitehall and settled into a grey job of accounting. Even his long-time personal secretary was a grey man, an ageless, sexless individual with the leaking balloon name of Sosa. Prime ministers came and went. Victoria gave way to Edward, and Edward to George. Budgets were slashed and expanded. Wars were fought. Decades of bureaucrats flourished and died, while Mycroft walked each morning to his office and settled to his account books.
That was The God of the Hive by Laurie King. Four friends, recent college grads, travel to Kenya to work at a refugee camp for Somalis. After 12 weeks, they're ready for a break. They pile into a Jeep, set off for a little R&R, but get way more than they bargained for. They're hijacked. They wake up in a hut, hooded, bound, no food or water. In Night Ranger, book 7 of the popular John Wells series by Alex Berenson, Wells goes underground in East Africa to find the captives. Upon arrival, he finds the truth behind the kidnappings is far more complex than he imagined. The clock is ticking. The White House is edging closer to an invasion of Somalia. If Wells can't find the hostages, they'll be dead, and the U.S. could be drawn into a war. George Weedell narrates.
Gwen decided to give herself an extra long, extra hot shower this morning. Moss wouldn't be amused. Moss said any shower more than 3 minutes long was a waste of time and water. But it wasn't Moss's birthday, was it? The Hagadera camp was one of three giant refugee centers near Dadaab, an overgrown village on the dusty plains of eastern Kenya. The camps opened in 1991, when Somalia's government first collapsed. For most of their existence, they'd held fewer than 100,000 refugees. But since 2009, drought and war had caused hundreds of thousands of Somalis to flee their homes. With nowhere else to go, they trekked west across the desert toward Kenya. Along the way, bandits stole from them and raped them. If they were too weak to walk, they got left behind. And not for the rapture. They died of dehydration or starvation. Hyenas and lions dragged away their corpses. Even when they reached Kenya, they weren't safe. The Kenyan police demanded bribes and threw the Somalis back over the border if they didn't pay. But enough refugees got through that 500,000 now lived in the camps, in endless rows of tents that studded the land like anthills. Some received sturdy white tents that looked like they belonged in an upscale camping expedition. Abercrombie and Kent journeyed to Dadaab. The others built their own shelters out of plastic sheets and scraps of wood. Vast open plains surrounded the camps, but the Kenyan government refused to expand them. So the tents were crammed into ever smaller plots as new refugees arrived. Each was a miniature city of refugees with a city's problems. Gwen hadn't known any of this when she'd come to Dadaab 3 months before with Haley and Owen Broder and Scott Thompson. The four of them had just graduated from the University of Montana in Missoula. Gwen had grown up in western Montana, lived there her whole life. She was ready for a change, an adventure. Then Scott said he might go to Kenya to work for his Uncle James, helping refugees. Gwen was surprised. Scott had never struck her as caring. In fact, when it came to women, she knew firsthand he was exactly the opposite. But he told her that James ran a charity called World Cares. "We can go to Africa for a few months. Beats hanging around here," he said. "Plus, when we're done, we'll go on a safari, watch lions getting it on. You know, they have sex for like 2 days straight." Scott sounded at least as enthusiastic about the lions as the refugees. That night she googled Dadaab. The pictures shocked her. She couldn't believe people still starved to death. Of course, anorexia, but that was different. Anyway, the point was that the refugees were starving. United Nations says 750,000 Somalis at risk from famine, the headline said. Worst food shortage since 1991. Babies with bellies swollen from hunger. Women with arms like sticks. Gwen decided right then that she'd go, do whatever it was that aid workers did. When she told her family about her plan, she figured her mom, and certainly her dad, would put up a fight. Aside from a few weekends in Canada, she'd only been out of the United States once on a spring break trip to Cancun. But they didn't. "It'll be good for you," her mom said. "Broaden your horizons." Then Haley decided to come too. She told Gwen she wanted a better shot at med school. She had applied her senior year, but her test scores weren't great, and the only place that accepted her was in the Caribbean. "This stuff looks great on your resume," Haley said. "In the interviews, too. When I saw little Dikembe come back to life, I knew I wanted to be a healer. I don't have to tell them that the kind of healing I'm talking about is dermatology. Laser skin peels for $500 a pop." "Isn't that a little cynical?" "It's a lot cynical, but doctors make mucho dinero, and unlike you, I can't afford the luxury of being an idealist. I'm not rich. Gwenny, rich people always say that."
We've just heard Night Ranger, Book 7 in the John Wells series by Alex Berenson. Readers, case closed. I hope today's literary investigation has uncovered clues as to which title you want to read next. For more ideas, check my website, bookreportradio.com. Thanks so much for journeying along with me into this great genre. There's so much more to explore. Let's meet again next week on The Book Report.